As for concentration, it's a very directed, effortful narrowing of your awareness. Some cases you even hear it described as when you totally don't have any sense of the body or outside world at all. And you wonder how these two could possibly go together at all. There are some people who actually say that the Buddha actually taught two different paths. One is the path of right mindfulness, and the other is the path of right effort and concentration. And that the two basically go in, they claim, come to the same end, but they approach it from different perspectives. So in other words, you have one sixfold path and another sevenfold path. And it's pretty much up to you whether you went six or seven folds. On top of that, you have the question of basically what the two terms mean. And there's a lot of controversy around that. Mindfulness is often translated as bare attention to things rising and falling away, bare awareness, bare attention, acceptance, an automatic dropping of unskillful qualities that you just have to, as soon as you become aware of something that's unskillful, you drop it and that's the end of the problem. That's one of the explanations of mindfulness. Probably the worst misinterpretation of mindfulness is when they say a moment of mindfulness is a moment of awakening, as if this mindful acceptance is a taste of the deathless. It's not. It's actually part of the path. It's actually something that's fabricated. As for concentration, as I said, sometimes it's described as a state where you're totally blanked out. And neither of these descriptions fits with what the Buddha had to say about either mindfulness or concentration, and with the fact that he said that both of the qualities have to go together. Many times he will talk about right mindfulness shading into right concentration with no clear line dividing the two. He also does not have any place for bare awareness in the practice, because he says awareness or attention is always going to be affected by your intentions. If you ever look at dependent core arising, you've probably looked at it and say, well, that's a long list of stuff. I think I'll just close the book and that'll be the end of that. But one of the first things you notice if you look at it for a few minutes is that when the Buddha talks about sensory input, it comes halfway through the process. There are all these intentional elements that go before that, including intention and attention, come prior to sensory contact. So simply the fact that you're aware of something coming into the senses, you've already shaped it to some extent, what you're going to be noticing, what you're going to be seeing, what you're going to be doing with it. So there is no room for bare attention in his Dharma. He does talk about something called appropriate attention, is when you learn how to look at things in terms of the Four Noble Truths. You're looking for the issue of suffering, or you're looking for the issue of what's causing the suffering or stress. What can I do to put an end to it? You look at things with that framework. As long as you're going to have an intentional framework, make that be the framework. So there's an element of intention. There's also an element of understanding. It's already there. This is not just bare attention or bare awareness. It's directed toward a particular end. As the Buddha said, all the factors of the path are fabricated. And so what we're doing is taking this process of the word fabrication here is sankhara in Pali. It means the way the mind puts things together. And we ordinarily put things together in ignorance, which is why we suffer. And we don't look at how we're doing things. We don't understand what we're doing as we deal with sight, sound, smells, taste, tactile sensations, issues coming up in the course of the day. And he's basically saying, well, let's learn how to do this with knowledge. And you can learn how to fabricate with knowledge, and that turns this process of fabrication from being a problem actually into part of the path. So what we'll be looking at this weekend is how mindfulness and concentration actually work together in this process of fabrication. When the Buddha defines mindfulness, he does not define it as broad acceptance. In fact, broad acceptance is the term that he defines as equanimity. It's a different quality. It's one of the skillful qualities you want to develop, but it's only one. There are many other qualities that need to go along with it. He actually defines mindfulness as a factor of memory. We'll be looking at these passages I meant, but just let me read this description. What is the faculty of mindfulness? There's a case where you're mindful, highly meticulous, remembering and able to call to mind even things that were done and said long ago. You remain focused on the body in and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful, putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. You remain focused on feelings in and of themselves, the mind in and of itself, mental qualities in and of themselves, ardent, alert, and mindful, putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. Notice that first part of that definition, your mind, you're remembering things. Mindfulness is the process of active memory, of what you're going to call on as you're dealing with something, as you're going through the path, working on the path. These are the things that you want to keep in mind. And basically what you want to keep in mind is the framework of the Four Noble Truths. Okay, we're looking for the issue of where's the stress or suffering here, what's causing it, and then what could be the cessation and how you put it, how you practice to bring an end to this end to stress and suffering. And then there are duties that go along with that. This is in the definition there, we talked about being ardent. This is what the ardency means, is that you realize that you don't just sit there and watch things come and go and that's the end of the problem. You realize that things are coming up and I've got to do something with them. Again, the mind is an active process. It doesn't just sit there and receive things passively. You're actually out there shaping experience. So what are you going to do with your experience? And you want to have a good framework in mind so you can figure out, okay, given this situation, given this problem, what's the line of approach that I should take? So it's basically a factor of memory, the ability to keep things in mind with the purpose of knowing what to do with them. Secondly, here's some passages that talk about mindfulness, which doesn't sound like broad acceptance. Okay. Just as a person whose turban or head was on fire would put forth extra desire, effort, diligence, endeavor, earnestness, mindfulness, and alertness to put out the fire on his turban or head, the same way you should put forth extra desire, effort, diligence, endeavor, relentlessness, mindfulness, and alertness for the abandoning of unskillful qualities as they arise in the mind. You're not just sitting there watching the flames on your head and saying, aren't these beautiful flames? You know, let's appreciate the flames. You've got to put them out. There's another passage where the Buddha says, okay, you are mindful to abandon wrong view and to enter into right view. You're mindful to abandon wrong resolve, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, and enter into the right version. So you're not just mindful of what's coming. You say, I've got something I've got to do here. And you keep that in mind. As for the relationship between mindfulness and concentration, the Buddha often talks about how the establishings of mindfulness, which are, you know, the body, feelings, mind states, mental qualities in and of themselves, these are the themes of concentration practice. This is where you get focused. So it's not like you drop mindfulness and focus on something else. You just take that focus and you develop it and you get stronger and more solid in it. And that becomes the theme of your concentration. You also talk about how doing mindfulness properly will lead directly into jhana practice. Jhana is the term for the absorption that constitutes right concentration. So it's important to get a right understanding of what mindfulness is, what concentration is, and how the two of them fit together for the purpose of the progressing on the path. Okay. This has special wider implications now. It goes beyond just kind of the Buddhist scene because mindfulness has become an industry. You have mindfulness consultants going into major banks in New York. You know, wherever there's an industry, there are vested interests, right? Okay. Someone sent me an email, printout from, I think it was Bloomberg News, about how Wall Street traders are now practicing mindfulness. And some of them were claiming that it gives them a more instinctive sense of when to buy and when to sell. And I find that scary. You go onto the Live Sciences website, and they have a description of what mindfulness is good for, including, I kid you not, better sex life for women. Why it was just the women, I don't know. And it also makes soldiers more effective killers. Yeah, yeah. So they can kill with less remorse. Okay. Now, a lot of these claims, you hear it, I don't know how many times, that there have been all these scientific studies of mindfulness and what it does for you. Finally, there's been kind of a reaction. There are some people who, the NIH, the National Institute of Health in Washington, for years would sponsor mindfulness research projects, and the money was coming in, and all these researchers were doing the research, and finally, the NIH did what it always does, is after several years of research, it'll do a meta-analysis, M-E-T-A, one T, analysis of the data, and they came out saying that this was all a bunch of, to use a technical term, garbage. That the research was very poorly designed. The concept of mindfulness was so vague. The analyst said that it was really useless. I know someone who teaches at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies, and all of a sudden he said he got a lot of phone calls from scientists who had been researching mindfulness. He said, could you please provide us with a definition of mindfulness that the NIH will buy? So there's a lot of this going on. So fortunately, some of this stuff is being called into question. The question, though, is what's going to happen to Buddhism? What's going to happen to our practice as mindfulness gets sort of shaken out like this and decide, well, there's no good anymore, and passed on? I have a brother who teaches in a business school, and I asked him, have you had any mindfulness people coming by your business school to offer courses? And he said, yes. He says, but we've seen this many, many times before. You get something is new and trendy, and people will work out a denatured version of it that can sell easily and be packaged nicely. And it will go through the business schools and go through the business community for a couple of years, and then they'll decide it doesn't work anymore because it's been so oversimplified. And then it'll get discarded, and people will move on to something else. And I'm afraid this is going to happen to mindfulness too. So it's good on our part, if you're serious about the practice, to say, okay, what's been offered out there has nothing to do with what the Buddha taught. And so for your own sake, get a sense of what he actually said about these topics. One of the questions, though, is where do these misunderstandings come from? And I find that there are basically two sources. One is a misreading of one of the longest suttas on the topic of mindfulness, called the Satipatthana Sutta, or sometimes there's the Maha Satipatthana Sutta, the Great Satipatthana Sutta. And there's a couple of misreadings here. One is the idea that it's a complete comprehensive treatment of the whole topic of mindfulness, and it's not. First, there's the structure of the sutta itself. The Buddha gives a formula for mindfulness. I read it to you just now. That's the case where you remain focused on the body in and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful, putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. Similarly with feelings, mind, and mental qualities in and of themselves. So you've got this whole formula. The sutta itself addresses only one small part of the formula, which means what does it mean to remain focused on any one of these four things? And it stops there. It has nothing about what it means to be ardent, alert, mindful, but nothing about what it means to put aside greed and distress with reference to the world. Now, the Buddha is always very careful when he starts a Dharma talk, or would start a sutta. He would start a talk, and then he'd give a question, and then the rest of the talk would be an answer to the question. And so when he gives you a whole formula like that, but then only asks questions about part of it, he's telling you, I'm explaining only part of the topic here. For the rest of the topic, you have to go someplace else. Now, because nothing is said about ardency in the sutta, many people assume, well, there's nothing you have to do. You just keep this in mind, and that's the complete practice. But the actual sutta leaves open the fact that there are all these other things that have to be picked up from other parts of the canon. So we'll be spending a lot of time on our discussion this time. Well, what about the missing parts of the formula? And what difference do they make in the practice when you take them into consideration as well? The second misreading is there's a passage in the sutta which for each of the topics, and here I'll read the passage which is on the body, states this. In this way, you remain focused internally on the body in and of itself. This is not in your readings, by the way. I have to apologize. I put together the readings several weeks back when Brock asked me to, we need some material up here ahead of time. And then 2 days ago, I went through my notes and I said, whoops. So listen carefully. Okay. In this way, you remain focused internally on the body in and of itself, or externally on the body in and of itself, or both. Or you remain focused on the phenomenon of origination with regard to the body, on the phenomena passing away with regard to the body, or on the phenomena of origination and passing away with regard to the body, or your mindfulness that there is a body is maintained to the extent of knowledge and remembrance, and you remain independent, not sustained by or clinging to anything in the world. Okay, there are actually three practices described in that, described and divided by the ors. First, there's remaining mindful either on something internally or externally. Then there's the being mindful of the origination, phenomenon of origination or passing away or both. and then trying to remain just mindful of there is this phenomenon and try to cut away any greed and distress with reference to the world. Okay, those are three levels of practice, and there's a sutta where the Buddha clearly lines them out as three separate levels. They're often glommed together as one thing. You're trying to be mindful internally and externally, arising, passing away, and not clinging to anything. Actually, they're talking about three stages in the practice. The other misreading there is that word origination. It says you remain focused on the phenomenon of origination with regard to the body, or passing away, or both. Origination here actually means seeing how something is caused. Now, it's often mistranslated as just arising. You see things arising, you think things passing away. But here the Buddha said you have to see how they're caused. And that's a much more difficult process, because as any scientist knows, just watching things arising and passing away doesn't tell you anything about what's causing them. You've got to go in and mess with them, change things, make something out of them, see how they respond. So you know, okay, this actually is related or this is not related. So what the Buddha here is actually describing is a much more active process. And it's like eggs. If you want to know eggs, you don't just sit there and put an egg on the table and watch it for a couple of days. You cook with them. You make omelets, you make souffles, you make scrambled eggs, you make fried eggs, whatever. And basically, the same thing with the mind. Right concentration is your souffle. That's when you know you really know eggs, is you can do a good souffle, okay? So those are two of the reasons why I think this misunderstanding came, is that one thinking that the sutta itself is an entire description of the practice. The Buddha at one point said he could talk for 100 years on the topic of mindfulness, right mindfulness, and not come to the end. And people could ask questions, and he would answer the questions, and he would never repeat himself, and he would still not come to the end of the topic. So there's no one sutta that's going to hold all that material. And then secondly is thinking that just arising and passing away is what it's all about. You've got to actually go in and figure out what's causing what here. Okay. Then you also get people claiming, well, I practice mindfulness in this way and it actually works. My mind is a lot clearer, my mind is a lot more calm, more equanimous. Okay, the Buddha makes the point in one of his suttas. He says, okay, there are some things in the mind that all you have to do is watch them and they will go away. Some of the problems, some of the causes of stress, all you have to do is watch them as they come and they go. And they kind of get embarrassed. I mean, there are parts of your mind that, parts of your mind lie to each other, right? And one that's been lying all the time, if you just sit and watch it for a while, it gets embarrassed and it stops. But not everything is going to respond that way. There's a lot of things that, well, you can look at them all day long and they'll just look right back at you. And so, as the Buddha says, there's some things, and we'll get to this passage later, that some things require what he calls the fabrication of effort or the exertion of a fabrication, which means that you actually have to work intentionally on dismantling what the problem is, reassembling your approach. There's got to be a more active part. So yes, there are some problems that will just go away if you learn how to be more equanimous and learn how to be more calm and accepting of things. But there are a lot of problems that will not. So for a more complete practice, one that deals more with all the problems in your mind, you need to have a range of approaches. So sometimes you do just watch, and other times you do have to actually actively get involved. And as the Buddha himself says, it is possible, say that you've achieved a nice state of equanimity, you can get attached to the equanimity. And that is a possible attachment. And he also says that there are many levels of equanimity. The level that is just okay about what things are rising and passing away, he says is the lowest level of equanimity. The higher level, which you have to develop, he says, is when the equanimity that comes from right concentration, when the mind is really solidly based. And even that has to be overcome as well. So, yes, the method does work in a partial way, but there are other things that need to be, other skills that need to be mastered for the practice. Okay. I'd like to stop there for a second. Any questions about what I've talked about so far? Yes. Okay, you've got to start with your head first. Yes. In the back, yes.
Yes. The phrase in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say something about that?
Okay, when you're focusing on, say, on the body in and of itself, you're not putting it in the context of how it relates to the world. In other words, you're not worried about whether it's good looking, you're not worried about whether it's strong enough to do the job that you know you've got to do. You're just looking at the fact that you've got this body right here, and what are the issues of the body taken out of the context of how it fits into the world. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're talking about taking this more active approach,
mm-hmm.
and so just thinking of some things that come up while sitting, like pain,
mm-hmm.
physical pain,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, in the other style, or, you know, just the watching it come and arise and go away is one way that some people have talked about dealing with the pain.
Mm-hmm.
If you're being more active, what kinds of things would you do
with the pain?
Physical pain?
Okay, first you have to realize that you can't take on the pain immediately if your powers of concentration are not strong enough. And so you might say, okay, for the time being, the pain is there, but I'm going to focus over someplace else. So I get my concentration strong, so I have a sense of well-being in one part of the body. And at that point you say, okay, the pain, I have the knee as long as it wants, I'm over here. And then once that part of the body feels comfortable and the breath energy feels good, then you can say, let's spread that good energy back through the knee. And to see what extent the pain in the knee is actually caused by just a bad energy flow. Okay, and then sometimes it'll go away. And that's one of the things that we work with when we're working with the concentration. And then if there's parts that don't go away, then you say, and you feel the concentration is strong enough, you say, let's start asking questions about it. Okay, which part of the pain is the worst right now? And does it stay steady or does it move? And you see, of course, that it moves and it comes and it goes, and you begin to see that it's not as solid as the perception you had. And then you start questioning your perceptions. Then there's the question, okay, is the pain the same thing as the body? Because it says, you know, the body is in pain. Well, I mean, the pain is one kind of phenomenon. The fact that you're feeling a body there is another kind. Can you separate those out? And then you begin to realize, okay, a lot of the problem is the perception that you're holding in mind about the pain. So you start questioning those. And one way is to change your perceptions. If I think of it just as sensation, 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 what does that do? And you start digging up the question, do I have some feeling inside that the pain is actually afflicting me? Is it that? Because sometimes you find that you've picked up these attitudes from childhood about pain that you're still carrying around. Like the pain is some evil thing that's coming to get you. And then here it comes again. Well, wait a minute. No, it doesn't have any intention. It's just a phenomenon coming and going. You can ask yourself, to what extent am I thinking about how long the pain has been here and how much longer it's going to last? What happens if I drop those perceptions? So that way essentially the pain in and of itself is not the problem. It's the mental pain that's you're causing yourself around the physical pain, and you're learning how to question the processes by which you're creating that mental pain to see that you can see through them and, okay, I don't want them. So these are various ways that you can deal with the pain.
But that, what you're talking about, requires a higher level of concentration as well.
Right, it requires a fair amount of concentration to stay with that. And also just to keep in mind the fact, okay, what is my duty here with regard to the pain? Is it to make it go away? No, it's to comprehend the pain. Because once you comprehend, oh, this is how suffering, the mind creates suffering. And it's good to keep in mind the fact that when the Buddha talks about suffering, there are two different contexts. There's the context of what we call the three characteristics, and there's the context of the Four Noble Truths. And the three characteristics, just everything arises, you know, it's passing away, it's going to have some stress. But suffering in the Four Noble Truths is a suffering that comes from craving, and that's something else. That's the added, you know. You know, you've already got one arrow, and the Buddha says you just shoot yourself with a few more arrows. And that's what you're looking into. Mm-hmm. Yes?
When you say just observe, there is often this word attached to just observe.
It sounds to me like a very superficial observation. While I've done some practice with the traditions that promote that approach, like Burmese Sadamhasi tradition, and you will be told if you just observe, you're not doing anything, and they would insist on observing penetratively and with discernment. So I'm a little confused there. Isn't that an active?
Yeah, it has to be active, yes. Yeah.
And how can you, I guess you elaborate on that, but how can you do any more?
Okay, well, the question is, when they say observe with discernment, the question is, what kind of discernment are you bringing to it? What are the tools of analysis that you're going to approach it with? And if you're bringing if you've got a framework in mind, it's not bare awareness anymore. You've got a framework that you're applying. And so you have to again look at what are the tools that I've been giving as discernment. What are the questions I'm being told to ask? Yeah, that's a fabrication as well. Because again, that you're telling yourself, I'm doing this with a particular purpose. What's the purpose? How do I analyze it? And you can analyze it into little moments, but then as soon as you stop the analysis, you go back to your old ways of fabricating around it. Then you've got a question, well, I've missed something here. And so this is why you have to dig into kind of what is the attitude that I'm bringing here? What are the approaches that I'm bringing here? What is my habitual way of dealing with this? Maybe I have to reconstruct it. This is getting back into that fact, as I said earlier, that everything you experience is, there's an extent of intention already going into that, and you're trying to work back into what are the intentional elements that I'm bringing here, and how are they affecting the fact of whether there is, you know, stress arising in the mind. You have to, There are times when you bring a minimum, and other times you have to go back and question, okay, what am I bringing here? And see if you can change the framework that you're using to approach. Yes?
Just like some clarification, please, when you talk about framework.
Mm-hmm.
Could you discuss that differently?
Okay, you can come at something with a question, okay, what am I going to get out of this? That's a framework. And that's got a you in there, and it's got a get in there. And if you bring it, say, you think in terms of the Four Noble Truths, then it has a different set of duties that go along with it. The question now is, okay, where is the stress in here? And which is the stress that's mental, which is just physical? What do I do with that? You try to comprehend that. Okay, what's causing that? Let's try to abandon the cause. There's an active some duty that goes along with the framework.
In the First Noble Truth, when it suggested that suffering should be understood, how does that fit in with a framework?
Okay, well, that's telling you, right, that you've got this framework of four truths and four different duties. And a lot of times we get the suffering and we say, I want this to go away. Wrong duty. It's like going into a house. You see the house is filled with smoke, and you try to put out the smoke. Okay. What you actually do is like find the fire, put out the fire, and the smoke will go away. You know? So comprehending the smoke means figure out, okay, where is the smoke coming from? And then, okay, I've got certain qualities that I have to develop. And you know, and the precision of observation is one of the qualities, but there are other qualities you need to develop as well to go along with that. And that becomes part of developing the path, which is the duty with regard to the path. Okay. Question over here. Thought I saw a hand here.
Oh, sorry. No,
yes. Oh, sorry. Yes.
Going back to the beginning, you said about something controversial about the concepts awareness. So there are different interpretations.
Mm-hmm.
So does it become then a matter of personal choice?
Well, if the question is, okay, which methods really work and how far do they work? And because it's not, if it were just a matter of personal choice, you could say, you know, do you prefer a pink Jaguar or would you like a red Jaguar? It doesn't really make a difference what color Jaguar you drive, because they'll drive pretty well, both of them. But if the question is, you know, would you rather have a Jaguar or would you rather have, you know, a Yugo? And I don't know, I'd probably go with the Yugo, knowing what Jaguars are like, and I don't know how much they cost. But, but I mean, it really does make a difference when certain methods can take you only so far, and then they stop.
But how do you know?
Well, you try them. Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on. Let's look at some of these passages on mindfulness. Okay, passage number one. This is the one I read to you just now. The Buddha's here giving you a double definition of mindfulness. The first one is the one that has to do with the ability to remember, keep something in mind. You're mindful, highly meticulous, remembering and able to call to mind even things that were said and done long ago. Okay, here in the practice, this would mean, okay, you've heard about the Four Noble Truths, you've heard about the duties with regard to the truths. You keep that in mind when you're approaching something. Or in terms of what you actually learned from your practice, what has worked in the past, what has not worked in the past, keep that in mind as well. So that when a similar problem comes up, you figure, okay, I've done this before, this is how it worked. And you find sometimes that it works again, and sometimes it doesn't work again, in which case you've got to go say, back to the drawing board, maybe I didn't observe it carefully enough, or maybe this is a different problem. But you have to have that body of knowledge. You're not always with a beginner mind. You have to have some sense, okay, I've been here before. Some things are pretty easy to figure out and learn the pattern. And whether they're easy or not, it's important that you learn patterns. Understand the pattern of cause and effect. Because we are, as I said, we're looking for this process of origination. When these things arise, why do they pass arise? What's connected? And just very precise observation is not going to see that, because you have to see the pattern of where did this come from? Because sometimes the pattern, what it came from is something that happened in the past. And you have to be able to keep that in mind. And then we've got the formula here for of the mindfulness practice. And notice that the whole thing here is called the establishing of mindfulness, that whole formula. You remain focused on the body in and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful, subduing greed and distress with reference to the world. You remain focused on feelings, mind in and of itself, mental qualities in and of themselves, ardent, alert, and mindful, subduing greed and distress with reference to the world. This is the faculty of mindfulness. Now, body here covers any focus on any topics related to the body, such as the breath, being aware of your posture, being analyzing the body into its 32 parts, 31 in the canon, but 32 in the commentaries. And actually those 32 parts, that's not a complete list. There's actually a lot more parts. Eyes somehow got dropped off the list. What they call the charnel ground meditations, you really reflect on the fact that this body someday will be like a corpse. It will be a corpse, like corpses you've seen in the past. And each of these exercises is done for a specific purpose. The breath exercise is mainly for giving you a good foundation with a sense of ease with the breath. You can analyze the body into its 32 parts, either as a way of dealing with lust or as a way with dealing with pride over the body, or the opposite of that is lack of self-esteem over your body. You can say, well, these body parts that I've got, Miss America, she has the same parts. Beyoncé has the same parts. Who's the latest male movie star? I don't know. I lose track of these things. Monks date themselves very easily by the movies they talk about. At any rate, they all have the same body parts. Nothing different from yours. Similarly with the charnel ground meditations, it's to get a sense of, okay, this, the pride that you can take, say, looking fit and healthy, and say, wait a minute, this fit and healthy body is going to abandon me someday. We were invited one time in Bangkok to visit a man who was in the hospital. His children had called up and said, you know, please visit our father. He's got cancer. He's probably not going to last very long. And so we went there. He had liver cancer. And the head monk was talking to him about, okay, now's the time to let go about concern for your body and just focus on the state of your mind so that when the pain comes, it's not going to, you know, overwhelm you. And the man suddenly blurted out. He said, well, it's not the pain that's getting to me. It's the embarrassment. Turned out he had been a real fitness nut all of his life. And all that time spent, you know, being a fitness nut hadn't prevented cancer. And now he said, now my belly is so swollen. He used to look down at people with swollen bellies, all this fat, flabby people, and now look at me. And I kept thinking, the last thing you should be worried about is you're dying. I mean, but if you have that tendency, it's going to be hard to let it go. So it's good to learn how to let go of that ahead of time. So those are some of the topics with the issue of the body. Feelings in and of themselves, you are told to look at feelings and just classify them as pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And also the question of whether they are based on, as the Buddha says, feelings that are just based on sensual pleasure or feelings that are based on strong concentration. Learn how to classify those out. Now, the ones that are based on strong concentration don't just happen on their own. Again, when the Buddha talks about feeling, he talks about the extent to which every feeling has an element of intention within it. All of the aggregates, all of the body of feelings, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness have this intentional element. And so in this particular case, it's not watching just feelings coming and going, but you actually actively try to give rise to what the Buddha calls the stress of the practice, or the pleasure of the practice, or neutrality that comes with the practice, i.e. the stress of the practice is I've got a goal and I'm not there yet. He actually says develop that. Nurture that feeling, because otherwise we're distressed about other things. Really. So he says learn to stress yourself out about this and not about, you know, the stuff that you're normally stressed out about. And then don't just sit there being stressed out, actually use that as a motivation to practice. And then from there you can develop some of the pleasure and equanimity that come from concentration practice. So again, it's not just watching things arising willy-nilly, you're actually looking at things, some of which you are already having an intentional element in creating. So change the intentional element to give rise to something that's more useful in the practice. Similarly with the mind in and of itself, you're taking the mind states, and at first the list starts out with greed, aversion, delusion, a sleepy mind, a scattered mind, and then it starts developing into directions of a concentrated mind, a released mind, an expansive mind. And these are states that you actually develop. So again, it gives you some idea that this is something you want to keep in mind as you're practicing. Say you're focusing on the breath. You come up with, okay, what are the feelings sort of coming up along with the breath? And you learn to focus on the breath in a way that gives rise to skillful feelings. If you're with the breath and you find that your mind is scattered, okay, you work with this problem of a scattered mind. If you find your mind is sleepy, you work with the problem of the sleepy mind. It's not just arising and passing away. You ask yourself, okay, what's... Given in the framework of the Four Noble Truths, here's the framework again, what should I do here? Now, if you've got a concentrated mind, that's something you try to maintain. And we'll be talking about what the Buddha talks about. I'm going to get down to passage number 4, mindfulness as a governing principle, that some things you don't just let arise and pass away. Sometimes you have to encourage some things to arise and encourage other things to pass away. We'll get to that in a minute. Finally, mental qualities here. This is a list... And for those of you who are signed up for the Bellingham retreat, this is what we're going to focus on next month in Bellingham. List of mental, a kind of mental framework to keep in mind for different parts of the practice. Like you have the 6 sense spheres. And in that, it's not just watching things coming and going. You're watching, okay, when there's a fetter that arises there, what can we do to get rid of the fetter so that it doesn't return? Now, the fetter here means it would be the passion that would arise when you see something or listen to something or hear something. What do you do to get rid of that fetter? So keeping the 6 senses in mind as a framework means basically this is the framework with which you would go through the day And you begin to notice, okay, when I'm, you know, when I hear something hateful, or I look and see something really beautiful, to what extent did I actually go looking for it to begin with? You're close to the United States. You've heard hate radio, right? Yeah. And it's not hate radio. It's when you get these awful people who rant and rave about whatever. And, you know, it's not just that, you know, people just happen to find them on the radio. They go looking for them, you know. A lot of our mind does that. You know, a little bit of, I want to feel a little bit of lust. Let me look at something that aggravates the lust. You have to look out for that. It's not just you're sitting here perfectly innocent and, oh, something comes along. A lot of the mind is out there looking for these things, and you have to see that and learn how to stop that. So that's when you're keeping the six senses in mind as your frame of reference. Similarly with the five hindrances or the seven factors for awakening. The hindrances are things you want to get rid of. The seven factors of awakening are qualities of mind that you actually want to develop. So that's what mental qualities are there. It's various lists that you keep in mind at different points in the practice. So this gives you more detailed guidance on what you should be doing with what's coming and arising in the practice. Any questions on that first reading? Well, your most direct experience of the body is through the wind element. If it weren't there, you wouldn't experience it. So it's primarily, and in Thailand they put the two words together, wind and breath are the same word. So that's how you directly experience the fact that you've got a body here, is the fact that there is an energy. Well, it's there. It's there, and it's the element that you can play with. Yes.
I actually don't understand why these two things belong to the same paragraph, that you are to be mindful, you are to remember things that are said, and then the next thing is to be focused on the body in and of itself. I don't see that. How can
you have to remember to stay focused.
Yes, but it's not remember. That's what you remember.
You remember to stay focused. And
remember to stay focused, but it's not things from the past.
Well, it will be things like you heard about meditation, you've heard about the Four Noble Truths, you've heard about these different teachings, so that when you are with the body, then the question is, what are you going to do when things come up? Like if you've received instructions, that just to be aware, okay, those are instructions you remember. Well, it's basically your active memory. You're trying to, when something is needed, you're able to call on it. And what I forgot to point out here was that you've got the words alert and mindful as well, and we'll be going into that a little bit more. The alertness is what's actually doing the watching. And then the ardency is what's, okay, let's do this skillfully. Whatever is the duty that's called for. I have more on alertness here. We'll get down to ardency a little bit more. One thing I want to point out, though, is that the word here that I'm translating as alertness is sometimes translated as clear comprehension. The word is sampajanya in Pali. And in some explanations, that's the wisdom faculty. Like you are alert to things, or you clearly comprehend things as stressful, not self, impermanent. And in the tradition that I was trained in, alertness is just that. And in the Pali Canon, it's described as just, you know, you're aware of what's there when it's there. And when it's gone, you're aware that it's gone. And the ardency is actually the more the wisdom faculty, that given this is what's arising, what should I do? That's where the wisdom comes in. Because the Buddha, as the Buddha said, the beginning of wisdom is the question, what when I do it will lead to long-term suffering? What when I do it will lead to long-term welfare and happiness? And the wisdom there is realizing the great, what I am doing is making a difference. And so therefore you want to do it skillfully. So it's the wisdom that comes through action, the wisdom that comes through trying to realize that you're, what you're doing is making a difference.